How many of you grew up in a church where you recited the Lord's Prayer every week? Yeah, we did at Goshen City. At least that's what I remember. And so it becomes one of the first prayer formats that a lot of people ever hear or ever learn about or ever have ingrained in our being. That aspect of worship that goes with us everywhere from that. So this morning we're embarking on this new series, this late summer series called Seeking Peace with God. And over the next several weeks, we'll talk about peace with God, peace with ourselves, peace with others, and peace with creation. And the fact that we seek peace together suggests an important awareness that we can't achieve peace on our own, because peace and its alternatives are embedded in relationship. Relationship with others, yes, but also relationship with God. And one of the ways that we relate to God is through prayer. As I understand it, authentic prayer begins with self-examination, because peace can't begin out there if it doesn't first begin in here. So here's what I've learned about myself this week. I learned that I'm a pastor who struggles with religion and the church. I'm a pacifist who gets really, really angry. I'm a believer with an incredible capacity for doubt, which means that I believe God loves you no matter what, but sometimes have a hard time believing that about myself. I'm an Anabaptist who leans toward our radical pietist roots. I'm a sojourner seeking signs of God's kingdom, who's scared to death of what it might cost me. And I'm a praying person who often wonders if it makes any difference, but from time to time has caught glimpses of God at work. The last one being important, because in our text for today, Jesus says, pray. And the things he calls us to pray for can guide and direct us toward peace. Now, one of the first things that Jesus talks about in talking about prayer here is that it's not just a bunch of words strewn together. It's a connection. It's a relationship. It's seeking after the things of God. So when Jesus tells his disciples to pray, it's not about folded hands and bowed heads. It's about living into faith and living into the connection between us as individuals and God. Now, most of us are familiar with this text that's known as the Lord's Prayer. And maybe it was one of the early forms of prayer that you encountered. Maybe it was a memory verse that you recited each week. And maybe your recitation found you in connection with other Christians around the world. But it's not just about words or commonalities, because Jesus is essentially laying out how believers or followers of Jesus are to live. And as he prays, Jesus depicts how we are to relate to loved ones, but also enemies, to victims of injustice, and the poor and the oppressed, to religious institutions and authorities, all of which make up God's kingdom. A kingdom which I believe was at the heart of the good news of Jesus and the goal of his transformational existence. Now, I recognize, and I'm sure you've recognized it too, that the opening of the prayer can come off as misogynistic or archaic with this masculine reference to God. And I know some would rather substitute a wide array of gendered terms, such as mother or mother father. Some have even gone toward terms like lover or creator or source, all of which aren't unbiblical. But when it comes right down to it, I'm not sure Jesus gives two hoots about how we refer to God. Because what I hear Jesus saying here is not that God is male. I hear him trying to express a level of intimacy that touches something deep within us. An intimacy that binds us to God and to one another through a common understanding of our connection to one another. Because if God is mother, father, lover, creator, then God is those things to all people, which in turn is what makes God's name holy. Because the divine connection we all share, whether we believe it or not, is a sacred connection. So when we say that God's name is hallowed, it's because the human divine connection itself is hallowed. And that divine thread that binds all of us together should be hallowed as much as we hallow God and hallow one another. And when Jesus tells his hearers to pray for God's kingdom, I believe he's talking about a present reality, not some far-off eschatological paradise. And I know for some, the word kingdom also stirs up negative connotations. So it's not uncommon that people will use the word kindom, as in people we're related to, our kinfolk, to suggest that all of God's children are interrelated in some way. And I have no qualms with that. In fact, I like the familial notion that it projects. But I think we need to understand that kingdom represents the people's struggle, and that it was just as much political as it was religious, and in its injustice was responsible for the people's condition as the primary form of government in Jesus' day. And the kingdom of which Jesus spoke was as much about kinship and family connection as it was about upending the political system that divided and tyrannized the people in order to keep them under control. So when Jesus prays for God's kingdom to come, he has in mind a world in which peace through justice and equality is the governing factor. And the prayer he asks us to pray is that it become a reality among us. But peace in and of itself cannot reach beyond God without us. Because while God is the source, we are the agents through which God's peace comes into our world, a vital aspect of which is cultivating peace through prayer. If the first half of Jesus' prayer lesson is about God's kingdom, in which God's desire in heaven is equally addressed on earth, then the second half of the prayer is what that kingdom looks like from a human perspective. For example, praying for bread isn't just about praying for bread for yourself. That's easy. It's about bread being provided for all of God's people. And not just bread, but sustenance and provision. After all, Jesus has already told the tempter that people can't live on bread alone. And perhaps even more interesting here is that the same phrase that we've translated, "Give us this day our daily bread," could also be read, "Give us this day our bread for tomorrow." From this perspective, it's not about food for a day. It's about the banishment of food insecurity. Knowing that God provides in perpetuity, and in God's kingdom, everyone must be fed. Still, Jesus seems to recognize that before any of this can take place, the things that separate us from one another must be addressed. So he insists that God's kingdom must be a place of forgiving and being forgiven. So while we can scrutinize over debts or debtors and financial forbearance or trespass and sins or moral debt, to do so is to unfairly limit Jesus' meaning. In fact, some believe that what Jesus is speaking of here is the Jubilee, a seven-year cycle in which land that was sold in order for persons to survive was restored to its original owner. And people, sometimes whole families who'd had to sell themselves into slavery, were to be set free. So the forgiveness Jesus seems to be suggesting isn't just interpersonal, it's the restoration of financial equality, the restoration of land and rights, and the restoration of those most vulnerable and most at risk. That's not to say interpersonal forgiveness isn't important. It is, because we can't live out God's kingdom bearing the burden of grudges, broken relationships, and resentment in our hearts. Not that it's easy, or that we're going to like everyone. Nor does it mean that we must return to abusive, manipulative, or dangerous relationships. It's about freeing ourselves to create a better world for those around us, and therein, ourselves. Finally, when Jesus tells his hearers to pray that they don't come into a time of trial, nor fall into the snares of the evil one, he may be referring to temptations similar to his own wilderness experience. But that's not necessarily the case either. You see, for Jesus, evil didn't exist in one person. It existed in structures that oppressed and distressed people, and often trapped them in systems in which they did not have enough to survive, be that money, food, or what have you. Because once someone was under the thumb of an authoritarian institution, it was nearly impossible for them to break free. In other words, Jesus says, pray for the peace that can only exist in God's kingdom. But praying alone won't do it. Still, in praying, we are transformed. We are opened up to new possibilities in our world, and we're given a vision that exceeds what our earthly eyes can see, and calls us into a way of living that carries the potential to live out God's kingdom of peace. And Jesus tells the people to pray. First, he begins with the sanctity of our relationships and our common goal, to see God's kingdom as a present reality. And second, how we connect with God by caring and carrying out that kingdom with our sisters and brothers in the world. Because prayer isn't just about something we do with our mouths or our minds or even our hands. Prayer is what we do with our whole being as we navigate our world with our compass oriented toward God's peaceful kingdom.